28-year-old in 1961, Leonid Rogozov was excited to be appointed to a new station until he found out it was in the Antarctic. He was in charge of this station there as a doctor, 28-year-old doctor, and it started out, it was pretty exciting, but then in April, he started to feel sick. And he started feeling weakness, nausea, had elevated temperature, and a tender spot on his lower right iliac region. He instantly diagnosed himself with acute appendicitis. The problem was, there were no planes at any of the stations up in the Antarctic at that time, and the weather was so bad, no one could fly in if they wanted to. So he looked around at his options and realized it was he do it to himself, or he let the appendix burst and die. So he decided to perform surgery on himself. He was assisted by his meteorologist who helped with the medical instruments. Now, give me the sharp thing over there that's got a little arch to it. I don't know how he described it to him, but they're going. Then the mechanical engineer on the station held a mirror and a lamp for the whole surgery. So he's holding a mirror so he could see what he was doing. And what happened was he was laying in a semi-laying position on his left side. Here's a photo of it. Just be aware, it's black and white, so it's not so bad. It's still pretty bad. So he was on this. He injected local anesthesia with Novocaine and made a 12-centimeter incision in his right iliac region, partly with the help of the mirror and partly by touch. He started to search for his appendix. He had to pull some of it and set it up on this sheet there. The sight of Rogozov searching for his appendix in his guts almost caused his assistants to faint, recalls the station head, Vlad Gorbachev, who also attended the surgery, recalling that the assistants were whiter than the sheet that Rogozov was laying on. But, he said, they made great efforts to stay calm and remain throughout the surgery. 40 minutes into the surgery, Rogozov felt weak and dizzy, forcing himself to take a break every 5 minutes. Staying calm and collected through the entire surgery, he finished in 1 hour and 45 minutes. In 5 days, his temperature was normal, and 2 days after that, he removed his stitches. I don't know if he removed his own stitches or if he paid. At that point, why? A little crazy. You know, it's amazing what people can do on their own. And there's exciting stories like that, but you know, there's 100 stories for every one of those where we crash and burn when we do things on our own. We're not meant to do life on our own. We really aren't. Now, some of us are introverts and we need our alone time. And even extroverts need some alone time for the sake of the introverts. But we're not meant to do life by ourselves. We're meant to do it together. We're going to talk about that today. We're looking at what the early church did right and try to figure out what can we learn from them and implement in our church. And last week, Tim kicked this off in this series, When It's Done Right. And Acts 2:42 is our theme verse. And it says, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, to fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to prayer. The first part of that sentence is what we got to keep in mind is they devoted themselves. They weren't dabbling. They devoted themselves to these things. And last week, Tim talked about the apostles' teaching. And what's important about that is the apostles spent 3 years with Jesus and recognized that this is an oral culture. And so Jesus is teaching these things over and over and over. And he did use the same material from time to time. And he'd do it over and over, and the people would memorize it. They're not reading books. They're not necessarily writing things down. They're just listening and taking it in. So they've been with him for 3 years. They saw things that he did on the side, little things he said along the way on the path, little things, pieces of advice. They passed this on in their teaching. They didn't have the New Testament that we have. It was being written as they were living. So they were devoted to the teaching. And Tim quoted from 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 16. It says, all scripture is God-breathed. It's useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness so that the servant of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. So Tim emphasized that last week. And our church is based on the scriptures. We try to take the Bible as it is and try to interpret it for how we live today. And that's our goal on Sunday mornings is to give bite-sized chunks and challenges so that we can become more and more like Jesus as he calls us to be. But this morning we're looking at this idea of fellowship, the second thing. They were devoted to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship. The word here that's written in the original language is koinonia. Many of you have heard of that term. It's coffee shops and everything else for a while. Koinonia this, koinonia that. It is a cool word. It's this idea that you have a shared conviction. Because of that, you have a shared purpose and and you're the same status, and you share everything together. So it's this all-out, we're in this together kind of feeling. And in the New Testament, that word's used a number of times. It's actually translated differently in different places. Here it's fellowship, which is good. Other places in 2 Corinthians, it's the term giving or shared. Commune or communion is translated sometimes as well. So what's so special about this concept of koinonia, and how could we get something like that today? How could we experience that? Well, recently I was listening to a TED Talk by Susan Pinker, and she addressed the issue of what social relationships mean to us. Everyone knows, or most of you know, women live longer than men. Because they don't do things like, here, watch this. I wonder if I could stand one leg on this ladder and put another ladder on it. I think it'll work. They live 6 to 8 to 10 years longer than men. Everywhere in the world except for one place, they say. I haven't done additional research to make sure they're telling the truth, but the researchers say this. There's one place where it's not true, where men live the same as women, and it's Sardinia, an island off of Italy. This is before the coronavirus, so I don't know how this is going to work out now. but they still have some good numbers here, so I'm going to use them anyway. The idea of living long, 25% of it is genetic, 75% of it is lifestyle. And so they looked into these people. They live in clustered villages. They're these villages that are very, everybody's on top of one another, and generations live together, and they're just very close. And they're not like somebody lives in the country. They all live in these villages. So they did research to say, what are the top 10 things that cause people to live long? And what would they be the things that would stick out? The bottom things didn't have as big of an impact as like the top few had a huge impact. But number 10 was clean air. They said clean air is important. Number 9, treating your hypertension. Good idea. Some of you will be excited how low the next two numbers are. Number 8 is your weight. You're overweight, they say it's not as big a deal as you might think. Number 7, be excited, exercise. You knew it was going to be on there. Number 6, if you have heart issues, deal with those. Get the heart issues dealt with. That's always a good idea. The surprise one of the whole list is number 5. Number 5 is, have you had a flu vaccine? And it's those who had it live longer, just in case you wondered. But that's number 5. Yeah, now it's moving up. Number 4, their wording, quit boozing. They didn't say quit drinking, they said quit boozing. So I don't know exactly what that means, but don't booze. Their third one is a little clearer, quit smoking. The top two were the things that they spent the most time on because these figures were very high. Number 2 was close relationships. And they find those who have close relationships, that's the kind of person you call on when you're really having struggles at any time. Person who knows you well, will tell you hard truths and things like that. Number 1 is a really interesting thing. They call it social integration. What they mean is how many people do you interact with on a daily basis? They don't have the self-checkout things there and... I mean, you can get gas, get groceries, do almost anything now and not talk to anybody. But they talked about how you talk to the waitress, you talk to the bank teller, you talk to the grocery clerk, you go to a different place for your meat, your hair person, your exercise person, and the people walking dogs. They have a lot of interaction, and they have a lot of people who live together. And they say that is a huge impact on how long they live. So they wanted to ask additional questions because, you know, today we spend a lot of time online. What about face-to-face or Skype, or texting, does that count? Because they've said, the figures there said that the average person now is 11 hours online. Now I think, does that count like when we're sitting here and we just didn't disconnect? Because I know you're not looking at Facebook or anything right now. So they say 11 hours. They say that's an hour longer than last year. So does that count? They said no. They said, the thing is, neurotransmitters are released in face-to-face contact. It doesn't happen online. Chemicals, oxytocin and dopamine, are released when we interact face-to-face with people. Remember, we used to shake hands and all that stuff, and it was safe. Well, they say that has an impact on you. Now, we know women live longer for the most part because they do develop deep, long-term relationships. Guys are bad at that. Guys just aren't as good at that. What this lady found was that one of the people she interviewed, now, centenarians, the people lived to be 100 years old, they had more than 6 times the centenarians than the whole rest of mainland Italy has. They have 10 times more, supposedly, than North America. How can that be? I don't get it. She interviewed one guy who's 102 years old. She said, "It's the grouchiest man I've ever met in my life." She said, which I've decided that positive outlook on life has no impact on how long you live. But they went on to say, if you have 3 really strong relationships, that you are 4 times less likely to get dementia. They say strong relationships are more effective than some medicine, a lot of medicine, I'm sure, than when it comes to cancer and heart issues. They were just talking about how strong, much of a difference it makes when you have these strong relationships. Then they said the sad thing in the research that they found was 1/4 of the people they interviewed said they had no one to talk to about stuff. 25% of us. That's the number of us in here. To be honest, I don't have anything for you about how to live long. I don't have anything there. What I'm concerned about is living well, the years that we have. We don't know how many years we got. We could have some surprises this afternoon. We have no idea. But some people die long before they're buried. And some people live on after they've been put 6 feet under because of the influence and impact they put in people's lives. So how do we live well? How do we get that koinonia thing that the early church had? And I wanted to, I was thinking about a church and saying, you know, for a lot of us, we're like, we have the high relationships. How you doing? Good to see you. I don't know anything else about you. I don't know what makes you tick and what makes you talk. I don't know anything about you. And I would like our church to have clusters, at least, of koinonia. How does that work? Well, there's 3 things I wanted to look at this morning. One is, how did the early church experience koinonia? What did they do that maybe we could adapt? How can we create an environment where koinonia is possible here? And then finally, what tweaks or all-out changes does God want us to do in our lives now to do this better? Well, how did the early church experience koinonia? One of the things that was huge for them was their incredibly strong belief in the fact that Jesus Christ was the Savior. They had been with him for 3 years. They saw him heal people. They saw him cast out demons. They saw the love he had for people who were outsiders, how he called people in, how he just had this way with people, and how he was burdened. You know, tears that he would cry in his time of prayer. They saw his passion. Then they saw him arrested. They saw him beaten to a pulp. They saw him crucified. They saw where he was buried. They saw him rise. They didn't see him rise. They saw him after he rose from the dead as a resurrected body. They saw him. And then they saw him ascend to the Father. They knew that they knew that they knew this was true. And they weren't going to compromise any of it. They would give all for that. That's one aspect of having a strong koinonia, is having a strong faith. And that can come from being a part of community. Another thing was they were a persecuted minority with a common enemy. Jesus said, most of the time, in fact, all the time, he seems to imply, that we're going to be in the minority if we're true followers of Jesus. Because he said, wide is the way to destruction, but narrow is the path that leads to life, and few are those who find it. So they were a minority. They were a persecuted minority, and they had a common enemy. The enemy wasn't Rome. The enemy wasn't the Jewish leadership or the religious leaders. The enemy was Satan, and they knew it. And when you have a common enemy, that draws weird nations together for wars. I mean, that can happen. But they also were a persecuted minority. They had a real bond there. And then the thing that happened as a result of having this bond was that they were generous. They devoted themselves, as we said earlier, to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship and breaking of bread and prayer. But as they grew, in Acts chapter 4, it explains some other things that they did. Listen to how this Koinonia led to sharing. Starting at chapter 4, starting with verse 32. All the believers were united in heart and mind. They felt that what they owned was not their own, so they shared everything they had. The apostles testified powerfully to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and God's great blessing was upon them all. There were no needy people among them, because those who owned land or houses would sell them and bring the money to the apostles to give to those in need. For instance, verse 36, there was Joseph, one of the apostles nicknamed him Barnabas, which means son of encouragement. He was from the tribe of Levi and came from the island of Cyprus. He sold the field he owned, brought the money to the apostles. So this is one example. He sold the field and he said, we have some needs here. Here's the money from that field. I just want you to have it. What happens when we start to have fellowship and koinonia and generosity is guys get competitive. A guy named Ananias saw that Barnabas was about to get the Generous Guy of the Year award again, and he started thinking, I want some of that. So he and his wife went and sold the field also. They said, let's keep some of it, and we'll go and say we gave everything to the church. So what happened is Barnabas gave out of a pure spirit, generosity. Ananias gave because he wanted recognition. He wanted to compete. There is no room for competition in the area of koinonia. If you're trying to get the Generous Person of the Year award, you're probably going to be disappointed, because when Jesus was pointing out anyone who gave the most, you remember who he pointed out? The little old lady who gave a couple coins. He said, this woman gave everything she had. No one is exactly in your situation. No one can tell you how much you should give. That's between you and the Lord. But we have to recognize we're stewards with everything God's given us, our time, our money, our talents, and we're accountable to him. So there's no comparison. We're in different stages of life. Do you guys know when your kids leave for college, like there's the food is, it never disappears. There's always milk in the jug that's in the fridge. The water always gets refilled. And the potato chips don't like disappear as soon as you walk in the door. It's amazing. But then you can't blame it on the kids either when they do disappear. It's kind of. We're all in different situations. When you've got small children, the time that you have is non-existent, really. And so people saying, you're spending an hour in prayer? I don't get an hour of sleep. Your situation is different. You can't compare. But they were generous. How can we create an environment that has koinonia here? We've had about 300 people go through the Rooted experience that we use as a discipleship tool here, and just a way to get to know the church better. And it's a 10-week program experience where you go through with a number of people, sometimes as many as 14 or 15 people in one group, and you study about God, about the church, and about your own gifts, and you learn a number of things. But some of you were in groups, a few of you were in groups that maybe you just got a little bit deeper. But a number of you got in groups where you went deeper than you ever thought you would in 10 weeks. And I want to emphasize some of the things that happened in those groups that brought about some koinonia. And I also want to just mention in my own life the things that are required, that were required for people that I have koinonia with. The first one is this. It takes an investment of time. With the Rooted experience, we say it's 10 weeks long. You've got to be there at least 8 times. Most people try to be there every time because you don't want to miss out. When it comes to people you have koinonia with, a friend, they will invest time in you. And when our culture, time is the most precious thing we have. You can't get time back. And in Rooted, when people say, I'm going to be here every week, and there's people in that group that make special efforts to be there, it makes you feel significant because they want to be with you. It's the same thing with your friends. Those that I'm closest to, I know will do anything, put aside anything to help me out. And that means something. It's an investment. It's actually very purposeful. When you purposefully go after a friend to be with them, to encourage them, to spend time with them. Second thing is this, it takes vulnerability. When you meet somebody who's got their act together, they're perfect, their house is perfect, their marriage is perfect, their kids are perfect, I don't have anything in common with that person. And I can't relate. It's when we are genuine and we talk about our struggles that allows us to relate. And what's interesting is in the rooted experience, it usually the leader and one or two other people in the group will set the tone for how vulnerable this group's going to be. And when people start sharing, we do something where you share your life story there, some things about your story. No one is asked to share anything they don't want to share. But what happens is people start sharing things and you realize, man, I got so much in common with these people. I thought I was the only hot mess. Everybody here is a hot mess. And God comes through and I can't believe you're still walking. You're still got your life together and how much of a blessing you are in spite of what you've been through. And then you just kind of want to share your story. And what happens is we experience grace. These are our core values. We're putting them back up one at a time. Tim pointed out growth as it relates to the message he gave on the Word of God. Today, the idea of grace. I think we learn a lot about grace when we share our stories and we hear what God's done in other people's lives and we share our own story and recognize how good God has been to us. And then we learn how to give it to one another. When you get to this level of koinonia, when you're sharing stories and you're sharing things about your life and you're letting people become closer to you than probably you have in a long time, you start to become generous. You recognize how generous God's been to you, and you just want other people to experience what you've been through. We're taking a mission trip to Ukraine in June and July, and there's going to be this youth festival that's going on, and so they asked us to bring a bunch of youth with us because us old geezers just don't quite connect the same way. So I said, we need some young folk. So Donovan did a great job of going out and trying to recruit some of our youth to go along. So we've got, about 14 between the ages of like 16 and 25 going. The thing is, 16-year-olds don't have very big bank accounts. And 20-year-olds usually have less because they're starting college. So we've got the people, but the funds, they need to ask people here to help them with that. And this church is amazing. Rob Johnson is very involved in the missions program and is helping us, and my wife Sue and I are going on this trip. Sue's actually leading it, and I'm she calls the chief rebel rouser, is where my role is. But we've been made aware of the gifts that some people have been giving, and it's very humbling, and it's just encouraging. One of the notes I got was from a person who asked how much it cost to go on the trip, and I told her about $2,400. So she wrote out a check for $2,400. Another person here in the church wrote one out for $2,500, as well as supporting some other people individually. This is the note that came from the one with the lady. Please use these funds anonymously to help others who want to go to the Ukraine, but may have trouble raising the money. It was a life-changing trip for me to have the opportunity to meet and talk to people who had suffered and risked all for Jesus in a way we can't really understand in the U.S. I'll be praying for all of you as you prepare to go on this year's trip. That's what happens when you really get how good God's been to you and you want others to experience the same thing. That's very sobering. And receiving that is very special. That's part of koinonia. You get generous. The third thing is koinonia only really happens when you're all in. You don't dabble in Christianity, as I said before. Being all in, as a friend says, I'm taking you as you are, and yet I'm going to be real with you and be honest with you. Jeff Mahan was the only one that was honest with me the other night at the chili cook-off. He kept going like this. I thought, man, Jeff's got an itch. Finally said, Burton, you got sour cream dripping all over your beard. Clean that off. You know, a real friend is the one who tells you when you got something hanging from your nose out in public. A real friend is the one who says, you know, when you talk to that person back there, you seemed rude. I know you didn't mean it, but you seemed rude. That's what a friend says. But a friend doesn't go to you and say, did you see that? Didn't you think Joe was rude? You go to Joe instead of talking about him. That's what an all-in friend does. An all-in friend will do almost anything for you that isn't illegal, immoral, or fattening. Really, just immoral. I went skydiving as a freshman in college to overcome my fear of heights. It doesn't really work. But when I was going up in the plane, I realized, okay, you're a skydiver. If you go up in the plane, you come down in a parachute. If you go in the plane and land in the plane, you just went for a ride. You're not. It takes an all-out commitment. And you got to jump out and hang from this bar and you got to let go. I didn't want to do any of those things. But I didn't want to land in the airplane. In fact, the pilot said to us, guys, he's just taking off as he's saying this, just so you know, I'm a much better skydiver than I am pilot. So if you look up here and there's no one up here, you should jump. That's why it was only $60. To be all in our faith and with friends requires a step of faith. And I want to tell you that for me, the people who are closest to me, and we'll talk about this level of friendship in just a minute, it's a deal breaker if they're not a follower of Jesus. I've got a lot of friends, a lot of acquaintances, but the only people I want close enough to me to give me advice on my marriage, on my kids, on myself, how to improve, I want it to be people who have a biblical worldview and have my best interest in mind as it has to do with the Bible. You can get a lot of seemingly good conventional wisdom that isn't biblical, that isn't helpful. And so you've got to be careful of those you let in that inner circle. You can be my friend no matter who you are, but you're not going to be an influencer in my life unless you're one who has the Bible as your core. So Edward T. Hall, back in 1966, came up with this theory called proxemics, and he had four spaces that we use to develop personalities, culture, and communication, and Joe Myers wrote some on this and expanded on this idea. What I like about this is it just gives us some ideas of the levels of friendship. And the first one he calls public, and the public thing is like I identify with a certain political party or I identify with the Cincinnati Bengals and Cincinnati Reds. I'm a fan. Now, the Reds don't know who I am, but I'm a fan of them. Michigan State is my school that my wife and I went to, so we're big fans of Michigan State. The only thing they know about me is that I don't respond to the letters that they send to me asking for money. But they keep trying. I can't go to a game and say, I'm a grad. They'll say, so what? $50, please. There's no membership benefits in this public group. For Jesus, the public was the crowds, the thousands that followed him as he spoke. He didn't know them by name, but they identified with him. The next level is social. The social is one where there's a lot of people, and you know a person's name mostly, but you don't know that much about them. So you know a little bit about them. So it might even be a crowd like this right here. For Jesus, it was like when he went into households that had a whole lot of people in them, Mary and Lazarus and Martha in their home. There's a whole bunch of people that came to hear him speak. They know each other, but not intimately. Then there's the personal friends. For Jesus, he had the 12 disciples and the women that traveled with him. They went all over. For us, it would be close friends, coworkers, people who know you, know your kids' names, know the things that are hang-ups for you, know your strengths and weaknesses. They're very good friends. These are very close friends. The final one is called intimate. You might have two or three of these in your lifetime. This is that friend that you can tell everything to. Sometimes that's a spouse, sometimes that's one or two other friends. So with that in mind, we connect and we identify and we participate in all these different levels, all four of these levels. The public one, for the numbers and relationship, they'll say you have about 8 that you would have publicly, 4 socially, 2 personal, and 1 intimate. That's kind of the relationship between them. So the challenge of this is we're going to have this all-in commitment Sunday coming up March 29th. In a couple weeks, and we're going to give you more details on that. And there are people who are going to be baptized that day. We've got half dozen folks who want to be baptized. We've got more than 15 who are going to be joining the church, and we're going to be talking about starting small groups too, and so people can sign up for that. The thing is, let's say we're signing up for a small group, and I get 12 people who sign up. Some people already have an intimate friend, and they already have personal friends. They're looking for a social relationship at this small group. Other people are coming in expecting this to be very close personal friendships. The thing is, you don't manipulate people and say, you come to my group, you have to be a personal friend. You don't demand personal friends. It happens. Sometimes it's the chemistry. You know how hard it is for a husband and wife to meet another husband and wife and you all click together? Usually it's not that easy because it just has to fit to be a personal friend. So what do you do in that situation? Well, say you're looking for a closer friendship than what this group is. You can identify a person in that group and just have coffee with them every once in a while and intentionally make closer friendship with them and see if that'll work out. You can't take a whole group somewhere where they're not really ready to go, and I'll explain what I mean by that as we move on to the next section. The third question we need to ask ourselves is, What tweaks or all-out changes does God want me to make in my life in order for koinonia to be possible, both at the church and in my own life? And many of us need more personal friends. We just don't do this easily. Women are much better at this than we are, guys. We stink at it, and we need to be better at it, and we need to value it, not just because you'll live longer, but because you'll live better. Now, one of the things that Larry Osborne, minister out on the West Coast, I thought made a great point. He says, we're kind of like Legos. And I grabbed Duplos because they're bigger. They're easier to deal with. So he says, you only have so many receptors. This is a big boy. He's got a lot of receptors. And there's only so much you can put on there. Let's say, you know, we're saying you need to make friends with your neighbors. Okay, here's my neighborhood. Working at that. Make friends with the coworkers. Okay, I'm doing that. Don't forget about, you know, like where you get your hair done. For my case, maybe more where you work out or something. And that's what happens. You start adding things and it gets messy. Then you're told to be a good spouse. So you're working on that. Be a good father or mother. You're working on that. And then here at church, you need to spend more time with people here at church. Invest in people. And next thing you know, you got no room. And you think, I don't have any room for doing anything else. And that happens to a lot of us. What I want to challenge you to think about is, who are the people who are influencing you in your life? And after you spend time with them, do you feel like you're doing better? You've been challenged? You're more Christ-like? You're lifted up? You've been encouraged? Even if they've challenged you on something and confronted you on something, do you feel that you've grown after spending time with them? If not, remember Tim quoted 1 Corinthians 15:33 last week, where Paul said, don't be deceived, bad company corrupts good morals. Paul pulls this out of nowhere on 1 Corinthians 15. He's talking about the spiritual body and all this stuff, and it's kind of like, oh, I forgot to tell you that one time. Bad company corrupts good morals. Like, okay, and then he goes back on. But it might be that you've got a lot of people taking up receptor spots that are really not helping you become the person you want to be. And they're having influence in your life in ways maybe they shouldn't. And maybe you can simplify things by changing that. I don't know. That's between you and the Lord. But I'm concerned that if you have people in your inner circle who are not thinking what's best for you biblically, what's best for you becoming more like Jesus, then they might be giving you advice that is not helpful for you. So in your time of prayer and just thinking this week, I want to give you a few things right here. First of all, are you investing in your friendships? Ask God, am I intentionally spending enough time with the people that I need to be spending time with? Second question is, who speaks wisdom into your life? Are you getting wisdom from someone that's helping you? If not, invite somebody that you respect here at the church that you think would be helpful. Invite them for coffee and say you want to bring three questions and you'll buy coffee for them. Dick Alexander suggested this years ago and I thought it was a great idea. It's a great way to spend some time with somebody and they won't turn you down. And the third thing is, what do you need to be sharing with others? Jesus said, to whom much is given, much will be required. He who is entrusted with much will be expected to deliver much. We've been given much. It also says in Proverbs, a generous person will prosper. Whoever refreshes others will be refreshed. Who do you need to be sharing with? And what kind of things? You have wisdom, you have talents, you have finances. What is it that God wants you to share with other people? Ask him for that, and he'll direct you. Do you stand up with me? Lord,